In the time between recording this episode and its release, we have learned of the passing of Jeff Dement, the American Littoral Society Fish Tagging Program Director. Samantha would like to dedicate this podcast episode in memory of her good friend and the first mentor that she had in her career. He was a great naturalist, environmental educator, and fisherman who touched the hearts of many people. To keep the fish tagging program and Jeff's legacy going, donations can be made through the American Littoral Society's website, www.littoralsociety.org. Thank you for joining us. This is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Fisheries Pod, or support the podcast on Patreon or Teespring if you feel inclined. Our guest today is Samantha Glover. Samantha grew up on the Jersey Shore and attended Brookdale Community College, where she completed an associate's degree in environmental science before transferring to Stockton University in southern New Jersey. While there, she completed her bachelor's degree in marine science. Currently, she is a graduate student at Old Dominion University in a marine ecology lab working with Caribbean king crabs. Welcome to the podcast, Samantha.
Thank you for having me.
So the bio you sent me included a handful of past volunteer and other opportunities that you have been a part of, and I figured we would highlight some of them here in the questions instead of just listing them in the bio. And the first one I'll mention might familiarize you with our audience. You worked for the New Jersey Fish and Wildlife as a marine fisheries technician, conducting APAIS surveys, and that sounds pretty similar to a previous guest, Joshua McGilley. Do you know Josh?
He is my boyfriend, actually.
All right, so what is APAIS?
So it's the Access Point Angler Intercept Survey, and it's a recreational fishing survey to collect catch participation and effort data.
Did you have as much fun on board all the ships as Josh did?
Yeah, so I only worked with them for about a year and a half, so not as long as he did, but that's where I met him. We were on a boat together, or a boat assignment, and I did have fun. I only got to go on a couple, really, out of the whole time I was there working for them. But some days it was busy, some days it was slower, but I got a good feel for, collecting fisheries data and, getting better at handling fish.
And you also interned with the American Littoral Society's fish tagging program. I guess not being in the marine realm or familiar with the marine realm, I wasn't quite familiar. So what is the American Littoral Society and what kind of fish were you tagging?
So the American Littoral Society is a coastal conservation organization. So they do everything from the fish tagging program to environmental education, mainly focused around marine science. And they also do horseshoe crab tagging as well, which I know I listed that in my bio. And they're located in Sandy Hook, New Jersey, which is a little barrier spit. So they're next to the NOAA Northeast Fisheries Science Lab there. And the reason they're called the American Littoral Society is because they mainly focus, like I said, on the coastal zone or the littoral zone. So I was mainly tagging littoral zone fish. So we didn't really do many big pelagic species. So I personally have tagged black sea bass, striped bass. We would do fluke trips. So the guy I interned for who runs the program is named Jeff Dement. And he got his degree from Rutgers in natural resource management. So he kind of runs this whole tagging program. So the main taggers are recreational fishermen. It is the biggest recreational fish tagging program on the East Coast. So we have thousands of taggers from Maine to Florida. And my job as the intern, for the most part, was just receiving their tag data and inputting it into the system, and then also sending out recapture letters. So if someone's fish gets recaptured, they get a little letter. They might get a patch or a sticker, or if it's their 100th recapture, or their fish was, or they have, like, let's say that they tagged 500 fish and they reached that milestone for the recapture, so they get a hat maybe. So they mainly tag, again, the littoral zone fish, the striped bass, bluefish, fluke, etc. And the only times I would really tag fish is when we would go out with a school group. So sometimes we would do marine science education or talk about fish tagging. We bring a group of kids. Sometimes it was at-risk group of kids. We'd bring them fishing to give them a positive experience, and we would tag any of the that we caught, and they would give us their address with their parents' permission, and we would send them a letter if they got a recapture. We also did one big tagging trip with the public in the summer. It goes on every summer. I don't think it happened this summer due to COVID, but you can sign up and pay. I think it's about $75 to go on this trip, and you learn all about fish tagging, and we'll tag any fish that you want us to. If you do have a keeper, you're allowed to keep it and eat it, but if you want us to tag it, you can release it.
Kind of in the same theme, you also got to go down to Belize and take part in some shark tagging. Was this as a result of your experience tagging with the American Littoral Society, or is this a separate experience?
So this is separate. So that actually happened before that. It was in between my transition from community college to a four-year university. So it's actually completely volunteer. It's through Earthwatch. They're based out of Massachusetts, but they do a bunch of different conservation trips. So you could even go and do owl studies out west to like help scientists with that. But I saw the Belize fish tagging, or the Belize shark tagging trip on their website. And sharks are my favorite animal. I think that's what got me into marine biology. I know a lot of people love sharks, but I'm like, man, I really want to do this. And luckily I had my great aunt was able to pay for the trip for me. She really wanted me to go on it. I knew I wouldn't be able to afford it myself. She said, I want you to go and do this. And then my dad is an engineer and he works inside all day. So he said, you know, I haven't done anything really exciting outdoors in my life, so I'm going to come with you. And my dad actually came on the trip as well. And that's the first time he's been snorkeling and, you know, experiencing marine science, because he grew up on a farm in England. And we spent a week there and we helped tag a bunch of nurse sharks. I think there was two small juvenile Caribbean reef sharks that we tagged as well. But all that data goes to Global Finprint, which is a collaboration of scientists around the world that tag sharks and collect data on rays as well. And they compile it into this big database to help out with shark conservation. And a really cool result of participating in that trip is the main scientist who runs that, Dr. Damian Chapman out of FIU. He was able to discover a new species of bonnethead. And that's because we take little fin clippings for DNA. So that's really cool. So we all got an email about that and I was super pumped about it.
I'm sure we're bouncing around a lot in their chronological timeline, but in your undergrad, you received the Stacy Moore Hagen Estuarian Science Scholarship and completed an undergrad project exploring New Jersey commercial lobster fishery data set. Guess what kind of information were you able to glean from that data?
So it was a lot. It was my first time working with a very large data set of about, I think there was about 90,000 lobsters on there. Excel was crashing. It was terrible. But I mainly, just because it was a short-term one semester project, I looked at shell disease prevalence in the commercial catch. And we all know for the southern part of the North American lobster fishery, it is really bad, particularly. So I looked at lobster management areas 4 and 5 in New Jersey. There's only 2. And a lot of people didn't know that we even have lobster commercial fishing off of New Jersey. But I looked at shell disease prevalence and you can see it steadily increasing. I'm sure there's a correlation with climate change and warmer water because it puts stress on them. But I could see that over time it has been increasing because I think this is about a 13-year data set that I looked at. And it's more prevalent in the female lobsters because unlike males, male adult lobsters that will usually molt once per year, and that's the way that they're able to get rid of that epizootic shell disease. The females don't because they have to carry eggs in between. So they'll molt about every 2 years. So they accumulate more of that shell disease or it gets worse over time. They're not able to shed it off like the males do constantly. So you could even see the difference between the male and female shell disease prevalence. And then I looked at females carrying eggs versus females not carrying eggs, and it was higher in the females carrying eggs. There could be, you know, some energetic stress cost to them taking care of the eggs, and that might be why. So I didn't get to do any statistical analysis because this was kind of like a short project, but I was just able to kind of go through and explore what trends that I was seeing, and it'd be cool to see if anybody does something with that data set in the future, because it's a fish and wildlife data set that nobody ever really, I guess, bothered to do anything with, and my mentor knew about it, so he's like, let's look at it.
And were all those experiences we just went over, were all those kind of in between semesters of your community college and experience at Stockton?
Yeah, so I didn't do any internships for the 2 years that I was at community college, but in between I did the shark tagging with Belize, and then my junior year was when I did the American Littoral Society fish tagging internship, and then senior year was when I got the scholarship to look at the lobster data, and I graduated that May in 2018, and then I was able to present. Part of that scholarship was that they paid for us to present a poster at the student part of the American Fishery Society 2018 Atlantic City meeting. So that was pretty cool.
And doing all those different volunteer intern experiences, I'm sure you met a handful of people that had various backgrounds in the field. When was it that you decided to go on from your bachelor's degree and earn a master's degree?
I feel like the driving point was when I was trying to apply for a lot of jobs after undergrad. A lot of them were popping up, master's preferred. So that was one of the drivers for that. But then also, I always wanted to go to grad school because I wanted to continue research. And I saw a lot of people that had graduated from my undergrad or the school that I went to for undergrad, and they were pursuing degrees doing really cool research projects. And I'm like, I want to learn more about, specific areas in fisheries and aquaculture. And that's where I want to do research. So that's what kind of made me start seeking out places to go for undergrad, or mainly labs to be in and mentors.
So we mentioned in the bio, your master's work is focused on Caribbean king crab. And my only experience in the Midwest with crabs has been the one time I just happened to catch a blue crab 1,000 miles above the ocean on the Mississippi River. So could you explain to the listeners a little bit about the Caribbean king crab, maybe what it looks like and a few ecology facts about it?
Sure. So they are a spider crab. So they actually are the largest Brachyrhynchus crab in the Western Atlantic. So they can get pretty big. The adult males can get up to about 3 kilograms with their carapace width. So when you measure a crab, you measure it width-wise, not, top to bottom. So they can get about 190 millimeters, which is pretty big. So they're comparable to the snow crabs, also in taste. They do taste good. They are predominantly herbivorous crabs, but the adults will also consume, little benthic epifauna to get some of that protein, because as they get older, they need more of that protein to keep growing. They are reproductively active year-round, and females can produce consecutive clutches from a single mating every 6 weeks. So they also have the ability to store sperm. And one really cool fact about them is, compared to other crustaceans, their larval development is very short. So the larvae only spend about 12 hours in the coastal planktonic stage. And the molting from the megalopa, which is kind of one of their last larval stages, to the first crab stage, only takes about 4 to 6 days post-hatch, where blue crabs, their larval stage can last up to 40 days. So they produce fast, and they also grow very fast.
So your project is looking at these Caribbean king crabs and determining the feasibility of some quarries in the Florida Keys to raise these crabs in mariculture. So in the Midwest, it's not uncommon to see borrow pits along the side of the highways where crews quarried soil or rock when building the roads. Are these systems you're working with in Florida similar?
Yeah, they're very similar. So, the majority of them are limestone borrow pits, and you can just see them driving along the sides of the road. There's over 150 of them in the Keys.
So while you're studying the feasibility of these quarries, are you yourself using some small scale mariculture setups to test this, or are you just collecting some more baseline information? Or I guess, how are you determining if these quarries or rock pits are viable for raising these Caribbean king crabs?
I'm not setting up any mariculture right now. I'm just getting baseline information. So I'm looking at water quality, food availability, what predators of the crabs might be in there. benthic structure because these crabs need, they like to hide in crevices. So one thing I forgot to mention is they are nocturnal. So during the day, they will, you know, hide in crevices and then come out at night to feed. And the males definitely need those crevices so they don't kill each other because they could be a little bit aggressive with one another. So yeah, it's just mainly baseline information. It's exploratory. And it was mainly my advisor who had the idea and wrote the proposal for this project that we ended up getting funded through National Sea Grant because he actually found some of these crabs living in the quarries. And he was curious. He's like, if they're living in here, you know, might be a good spot to do large-scale mariculture.
I'll plead some ignorance. How does mariculture work? Is it with crabs? Is it just a matter of kind of putting a fence up around the pits so they can't wander off too far? Or I guess, how does it work? Or how would it work?
So these crabs don't really come out of the water at all. So we're not really too worried about them getting up and crawling out. But people have tried for this specific species to mariculture them in the past, and it has been successful, but they've mainly done it in labs, in tanks, and then also they've done floating cage culture. But the issue is with the floating cage culture is the higher density of crabs you have in them, they start to become a little bit cannibalistic and aggressive, especially the big males. So it was hard to do that in particular. Same thing with the culturing in the tanks, because they had to figure out a way that they wouldn't kill a lot of the larvae since they moved so fast through the larval stage. They were finding that depending on the density, they were dying, or they were trying to figure out how to clean the tank and they were, you know, siphoning out by accident some of the larvae. So, but they're pretty easy to grow. The only other issue is because they're predominantly herbivorous is growing the algae as well. So I guess the ideal situation would be that we could have algae growing in the quarries that they're living in to supply that food. I know with the cage culture, they would stick in, like they grow the algae on like little racks or screens, and they have to constantly go in and rotate them because they eat pretty fast too. They have amazing grazing rates. They surpass most grazers except for the stoplight parrotfish. And so they found the labor to be pretty intensive, and it's expensive to set up, especially if you wanted to do it in tanks. So the quarries that are already there would be a perfect scenario because you don't have to build anything, and you can, as long, I guess, as the water quality is good, there's benthic habitat for them, and you have a lot of algae growing, they should be pretty well off because they're hardy.
So with your project, do you get to work with any of your Caribbean king crabs, or you just kind of look at the habitat that they might be in someday and dream about what these little crabs would be doing in the habitat?
Yeah, so I do get to work with them. So there were a couple quarries that I found that did have some population. So I was able to, you know, grab some crabs out of there so I could look at kind of some population dynamics. So, you know, I take measurements, I take some blood samples, I sex them, I see if the females have eggs. So I was able to get some out of the quarries and physically finally be able to hold them and get some measurements, which is really cool. We just got in the field this past November, December, because our summer got canceled due to COVID. So it was really cool to finally see them, because all my knowledge, of course, growing up in New Jersey is all temperate. So now I'm doing tropical stuff. So yeah, it's cool to get to snorkel and see them too. And I know sometimes if you're lucky, you get to see them out on the reefs, but there's not really large numbers of them on the reefs.
And you kind of played into my next question. I imagine COVID had put a pretty big damper on your travel between Old Dominion, which is in Virginia, I believe, and mm-hmm. your work in the Florida Keys. And you said your whole 2020 field season was lost. So I guess, what did you do in the meantime, since you couldn't go down and snorkel in Florida?
So in the meantime, we were just, you know, working on other tasks that my advisor had for us. So, you know, just I'm working on writing a review with him, and then also just, you know, talking about when we could get down to Florida and finalizing my research proposal for the whole project, because my advisor, you know, wrote a proposal for this and got funding for it, but he's like, I want you know, Sam to kind of take a spin on it. And so I was able to kind of really write out the steps I want to take and what exactly I want to look at in terms of the mariculture for these crabs. So yeah, it was pretty much just setting up everything for my research for when the time comes to go do it. And then I'm just also working on other things in between. So, I mean, for the fall before we went, you know, I'm also teaching assistant, so I was concentrated on that stuff too.
Did COVID delay your graduation any, or were you right at the start of your field collection work, or were you kind of at the end of it? I guess, what impact on your total project did COVID have?
Yeah, so I lost my complete first field season because I started Old Dominion last fall, and, you know, we weren't in the Florida Keys in fall and the spring. We usually go and stay for most of the summer. So I did lose, you know, a whole summer's worth of field work. We got a month in, like I said, from November to December. And I was technically, if I was on track, I was supposed to be defending this coming summer. But because of that, it's not pushed back. I probably won't defend until next spring because I have to get another section of field work this summer for my, since I'm a thesis-based master's.
Well, did you use the time you were stuck at back in Virginia this summer to help Josh out with his work with the striped bass?
Unfortunately, no, because his field work got canceled too. Well, I mean, Vims continued collecting his data for him, but he wasn't allowed to go on the boat. It was just essential personnel on the boat. So, I mean, I did a lot of, he's been teaching me about saltwater fishing. So I did some saltwater fishing with him. And then we also have been fostering dogs all summer. But then we finally broke down and adopted the one that we have now.
Well, in your free time, when you aren't down in the Florida Keys, you also find some time to make some ocean art. I guess, how did you get started in that?
So I've always loved to draw since I was a kid, and I was always really into drawing animals. I do draw people sometimes too, but I always like envision that at some point I do want to either sell my artwork or use my artwork somehow for science too, like maybe even scientific drawing. But, you know, while we've been in quarantine, I'm like, you know, I really want to start selling stickers or shirts or something of my artwork. And I want to do like funny fish puns or, you know, stuff like that. And Josh thought it was a really good idea. And he's like, you know, I bet a lot of fishermen and even just fish nerds would buy this stuff. And it kind of took off from there. I got an iPad with the first stimulus check. And so that way I can make digital artwork. And it's kind of taken off. Like, I've been doing really well. Josh was kind of running my little small business for me while I was in the Keys. And, you know, I make stuff. Like, for an example, I did a red drum design. It's a drum roll, please, or a fluke one that said fluke you. And a lot of fishermen seem to be really into it. And I really enjoy making it because art is kind of like, you know, my therapy or my distraction, you know, when I'm stressed, and just my hobby in my free time, also besides gardening. But yeah, I've always been into drawing, and it's really taken off, and a lot of fishermen are buying these stickers. I have had to reorder stickers so many times now, and people are buying t-shirts and they love them. So I'm really happy that I'm able to kind of combine my love for marine science with something that I love to do on the side.
So if people are interested, where could they find your art?
So I have a Facebook page called Scaled Up, and then my Instagram is Scaled Up Designs, and I have an Etsy Scaled Up shop. So all that is linked on the Facebook page. And there's a Teespring for my clothes, because since obviously I'm a poor graduate student, I can't just order a bunch of clothes at a time and get them printed. I don't have the money for that. But yeah, I've been putting up designs on Teespring where you can buy some of the fish pun shirts as well. And I'm in the process of making some new designs that should be up soon.
Well, I wish you the best of luck as you finish up your thesis work, and hopefully able to get down to the Keys this coming summer and collect some more of your data. But now the tough part of the interview is over, as we are down to the final five questions. And this is a group of five questions I ask each of the guests to come on the show. And we always start real simple with, what is your favorite fish?
Definitely since sharks got me into marine science when I was a kid, I would have to say the bull shark. I have one tattooed on me. I just always thought as a kid, I'm like, I think it's super cool that, you know, they can go between the fresh and salt water, unlike a lot of sharks. So,
yeah, I'm sure you listened to Josh's episode, so you know what his answer was to the next question. But what is your favorite memory from your career so far?
Oh boy, I know his was meeting me, but So honestly, I think it was one of the volunteer trips I did. So I went on the NOAA ship Henry Bigelow up in the Gulf of Maine, and it's fisheries surveys that they do every year, which is pretty cool. And that's the first time I got to see gigantic trawl net and some deep sea fish that I've never seen before. So I think that was pretty cool because I got to hold a hagfish, and I had gloves on. I know it's slimy, and I also got to see a lumpfish and just some fish I've never seen before because of the depths that we were trawling at. So I think that's one of my favorite memories.
And hopefully you'll be wrapping up your graduate work in 2021 and be looking for a job soon after. But what is your dream job or dream location that you're hoping to end up in?
Staying tropical would be nice. It's nice and warm, but I also still have a love for temperate systems. So I'm not really too picky. But now that I'm doing this project and these crabs help with reef restoration, because my advisor actually did a study with one of his old PhD students where they stock these crabs onto reefs and they're able to decrease and maintain algal cover so that way corals can have better recruitment. And they actually did a 2-year-long study and saw three to five fold increase in coral and fish recruitment from stocking these crabs. So I thought it'd be really cool to maybe stay in the mariculture or aquaculture realm where I'm rearing animals that could help with either habitat restoration or conservation.
And if money was not an issue, what is one project that you would like to work on?
Oh man, money was not an issue. I think it would be really cool if I could do, you know, projects maybe in other countries with mariculture and helping it, like other countries that have, or areas that have coral reefs, maybe look at some of the major grazers over there and see if we're able to mariculture them, how to help stock them on reefs and help with the reefs. Obviously not just in the Caribbean where I'm working now, but like in places like the Great Barrier Reef. But yeah, probably figuring out mariculture of some animal that people haven't really looked into before. That'd be really cool.
And our final question, if there is one point or principle that you could have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
I'd say believe in yourself. You know, I will admit that, you know, I'm not, you know, the smartest person. I struggle with standardized test taking, and my advisor was kind enough and he waived my GRE score to take me in because he really wanted to have me in his lab. And I'm extremely grateful for that because I got, you know, shut down by other schools because of that. So I definitely say believe in yourself and like you can do what you set your mind to if you're passionate about it. And, you know, I keep going forward and achieving everything that I wanted to. So yeah, don't ever feel bad about if you get a C in a class or if you have to retake a class or if you don't get the scores you want, because if you're passionate enough, you're going to end up where you want to.
Well, Samantha, thank you for coming on the podcast today. It was a pleasure hearing about you and all your experiences and your work now with Caribbean King Crab. If people want to find out more information or get a hold of you, what would be the best way to do that?
I'd say feel free to message me on the Scaled Up Facebook page if you go and follow it. But also my email is sglove009@odu.u. So that's sglove009@odu.edu.
And if you would like to get a hold of me, you can find Fisheries Podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Fisheries Pod, or old-fashioned email feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. You can download past, present, and future episodes on your favorite listening app or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. And don't forget, you can help support the podcast with a monthly contribution through Patreon or by rocking some awesome Fisheries Podcast logo shirts, hoodies, face masks, and stickers from Teespring. I am Nick Kramer, and thank you for listening to the 108th episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember to believe in yourself.